Hello. Welcome to the Creative Shift Podcast. I'm Helga Henry. Join me in this space for conversation with entrepreneurs, intellects, business leaders and policymakers. So today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the imposter syndrome. It's really interesting that every time we feature something on the imposter syndrome, I get lots and lots of response. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, every type of business person, every type of person I've interviewed or worked with or coached, at some point will say, you know what, I think one day I'll get found out. Sometimes I ask myself what it is I'm doing here or how come I got here. And I think that's one of the keys to making the imposter syndrome almost work for you. And I'm going to give a couple of reasons why. Understanding that actually almost everyone experiences those feelings of self-doubt but carries on is quite a leveller and should, I hope, be quite comforting. So if you're about to do a big presentation, maybe you're going, like a colleague of mine was, to a conference where he felt like everyone else was more expert than he was. Use that nervousness as a reminder, as a sort of trigger for you to think certain helpful thoughts. And helpful thought number one is, everybody experiences this and they push through and so can I. So that's reminder number one. I think it's also a reminder for you to not dwell too much on yourself and your own feelings. What am I going to say? How are people going to think about me? But actually to shift your focus to other people, to look around, to see who else maybe who looks nervous, to offer them a friendly face or a smile, to greet somebody and really crucially, ask a question. So hint number two, focus on other people. And I've already mentioned hint number three, ask questions. I can't emphasize enough how useful questions are. Not closed questions where you're going to just play verbal ping pong with somebody. Did you have a good day? No. Oh. And also to remember, and if you've done work with us in terms of networking or communication skills, that sense of leaving people in a better state than you found them. So finding something of interest and finding out what's interesting, useful or important about that interest. Seeing that the conversation's going somewhere and following that on. If you do those three things, remember that everyone has some sense of self-doubt or imposter syndrome from time to time. That the nerves can be a reminder to focus less on you and more on the people around you and to make that initial contact. And then to ask questions and leave people in a better state than you found them, you'll find that the feelings of imposter syndrome will quickly pass and you'll move into a much more productive and happier place to be when you're out networking or meeting people. Give it a try. So I'm really delighted to have with me for today's Creative Shift podcast interview recently elected MP Jess Phillips. Jess, hello.
Hello.
Jess, I know you through kind of more social circles. Mm-hmm. My very good friend Alex McCorkendale is a great friend of yours. We used to have friendly rivalry about who knew more people in Birmingham, who was the better networked. I now bow to your prowess.
I don't play yourself short.
In that regard. But I was also really heartened. You've recently been elected as an MP. Prior to that, you were a local councillor. Mm-hmm. But on the day that you were elected, Duncan Grimley, who's a musician and DJ who works in the city, tweeted out something like, I remember Jess when we both worked behind the bar and she said, one day I'm going to be an MP. And now she is. So, and how long ago was that? Was that 2000?
About 2 years before my young eldest son was born, so 12 years ago.
So 12 years ago.
So 2000, I'd say probably about 2000, 2001.
That's fantastic. So first of all, many congratulations. Thanks. And without going into too much detail, what were the major shifts or what were the major steps in your becoming an MP?
I think that probably I was drunk when I said that to Duncan Grimley. we tended to be that way back then. So I always wanted to be a politician and wanted to have a go at having the challenge of it. However, that has upped and down over that, even just those sort of 14 years since I said that. Although I've been saying it since I was seven, I think. And there were huge shifts in my life in those 14 years. I'd say the biggest shift of all, the thing that gave me the greatest boost and made me feel like I was somebody, was having my children.
Right.
I would say that the day I gave birth to my eldest son, I mattered in the world. Yeah. I felt like, and maybe I felt like I didn't matter so much before, and I felt like I was somebody and that I could do things. Just made, you know, I was 22 when I had my first son. So I was only little and it just made me feel like, you know, anything was possible. I mean, obviously I only felt like that on some days. Many days it made me feel like nothing was possible ever, ever, ever. And my life was going to be miserable forever.
Did you feel like that immediately after the birth is what I was kind of asking myself.
I think I just felt fear more than anything else. But it made me, you know, I couldn't just, you know, doss about anymore.
Yeah.
I was somebody's mum, and that is a thing, isn't it, being somebody's mum?
Yeah, I remember meeting many years ago when I was active in an organisation called War on Want. The guy who ran it with me became a dad, and he said, I became a dad and suddenly I looked around in the world and went, is this the world I want my child to grow up in?
Yeah.
So I think becoming a parent often has a galvanising, and sounds like to me that had a galvanising effect on ambitions you already had.
Yeah, most likely. It made me want to be somebody, and I think more than it made me want to, it made me feel like I already was somebody, and so that things were more achievable. So if I could have a baby at 22 and still carry on and go to work and do all those things, it gave me fight. Having Harry. And then I would say there were two other big shifts in my life in between that time. One of them was working in a women's refuge, in the women's refuge at Samwell Women's Aid. And for many years, my politics had become mainstream, being a Labour supporter. Was just sort of like, well, everybody was for all those years when I was a teenager in my 20s and having my children, both my children, born under a Labour government. You know, it seems strange now.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, it had become very mainstream. There wasn't a huge amount of fight in it. And when I started working when austerity started to hit and the credit crunch and all that, as we used to call it, started to hit, and I was working in a women's refuge that had all of its funding threatened, I started to get angry again and get my fights back. And then whilst I was working there, literally 5 months after I started working there, the coalition government came about, and so I was really, really cross. And I thought that if you're cross, you should try and do something about it. I've never been a person who, you know, if I hate my job, I won't just moan about how much I hate my job, I will change it, which I understand is a massively privileged position. You know, check your privilege, I get it. Being in working with the most vulnerable and the poorest people in one of the most threatened services at a time when your enemy rises, basically, makes you more activated. And I would say the final biggest shift in my life that pushed me into doing things healthily or not healthily is my mum died 4 years ago. So when my youngest was about three. So her death, I think, gave me a real push into trying to. She was an amazing activist, an amazing woman who achieved so much, and it made me sort of think, oh well, get off your ass and do it, basically. Yeah. And also, when you lose somebody, you fill your time, you know, to cope and things.
Yeah.
So I found myself with two small children, lots of time to fill.
Right. Gosh, that's... there are the five regrets of the dying, which are things like, I wish I'd spent more time with my friends. But they also do five benefits of a major stress in your life, including the death of a parent. And often that can be, I became more focused, I became more purposeful, I decided my life was going to mean something.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like there have been some personal life events, becoming a mother and the death of your mother, and external events, but most notably, as you say, the end of the Labour regime and the start of what is now a new regime, that a confluence of those events, both personal and national, micro and macro, has been what spurred you on.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that you kind of went to a course about how to become a counsellor, and then 6 weeks later you were standing as one.
Yeah, I went on it was just literally after my mum had died, I got an email from the Labour Party. And I had only just rejoined the Labour Party. Rejoined the Labour Party in 2010. My mum died the following year. So I rejoined the Labour Party just solely to get a vote in the leadership. And they send you a million, anyone who's a member of the Labour Party, and I get it, they send you a million emails every minute of every day. And I happened to open one of those emails, and it was about, do you think you'd make a good candidate in any election, or you were slightly interested? And I rejoined the Labour Party to have a say in the leadership and to become an MP.
Right.
I literally decided I'm going to rejoin the Labour Party and I'm going to become an MP. And so one of the very first emails they ever sent me was, do you fancy being an MP? And I got all like chuffed, like they'd only say, like everybody does when they get an email from Ed Miliband, which is not from Ed Miliband. And they try and convince you it's from these people.
They've read my mind.
It was literally like, what an arrogant fool. They've only sent this to me. I really want...
Words got round, yes.
Yeah, I literally only just said it to Wendy at work. And now the Labour Party's asking me to be a member of Parliament. But it was, it was like a course about just standing in selections, because political selection, you know, the fact that this is not something to be proud of in any political party, is complicated. It's got loads of ridiculous rules. And those rules, I think, largely exist to exclude. And so the Labour Party have recognised this, and instead of just changing the system, they thought that they'd send people on courses in how to understand these ridiculous
rules. How to game the system.
Yeah, how to game the system. People who wouldn't naturally have been involved in politics. So I signed up, and they said, yes, we'll have you come on this course. And while I was on the course, it was over two different sessions. It was over 2 weeks, with 2 weeks in the middle. I did the first bit. And then I was asked to stand in a selection in the middle one, just as a have a go, from part of the West Midlands. And I was like, I don't want to, you know, I've just joined.
Yes.
I can't go and stand for selection already. Yeah. So I went to the first stage of the process, and then I was like, you know, this is too soon. And also my heart wasn't in it, because it was in a place I don't know and or love.
Yeah.
Got rung up, and basically, after I'd finished the course, and I got rung up and asked to stand in a council election, because they needed a woman, because it was a woman's shortlist, and so I did, and I was elected 8 weeks later onto Birmingham City Council, and that was in the space of about 4 months. Right. All of that happened to me,
and in fairly short order. I think within a year they'd called the general election, and you were...
Yeah, well, the general election was because of the Act of Parliament, was everybody knew which day it was going to be.
Yeah.
And then they started pretty much about 3 years out from the election to select all the key seats, as they called them. And I, at the course that I went to train to stand in selections, they encouraged you to make a plan. To say which seats, you know, I'm not willing to go miles away. And some people who were there were willing to stand anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
My kids live in Birmingham. I'm from Birmingham. My heart is here. I can't imagine representing another seat, although I'm sure I'd be able to manage if I had to. But this is my home. And the only seat that I could go for in Birmingham was either Sutton Coldfield or Birmingham Yardley, because all the others have Labour MPs, I'm pleased to say.
Yes.
So they wouldn't be available. So I had already, even back then, thought, OK, then we'll conveniently, that's where all my family are from. I will go for Birmingham Yardley because that's the only seat where I don't have to have my children move to a different city. So I went about working it. I made a plan, and it started 4 years out from the election, and I worked on that plan, and it paid off.
Wow. Well, so, as you know, another thing that we're interested here at Creative Shift is about confidence. Mm-hmm. And I'm a different generation to you. There were fewer women politicians around, with the notable exception of Dame Jill Knight Margaret Thatcher. And I suppose whatever political leanings I may have had, I seem to remember being sort of talked out of by my family because they went, oh, you have to know about a lot of things. Yeah. What if they ask you about the Middle East?
Well, they do at the moment.
But what if they ask? And I just thought, oh, I haven't got, for all that I'm a fairly confident person, I felt like I didn't have the confidence to opine about or to have a strategy about those things. And then, of course, and it hasn't really changed, the sort of barracking, the bear pit that is the chamber, the House of Commons, just didn't seem like an environment which anybody would thrive. So how did you have any qualms about, did you have similar qualms? How did you get the confidence to do it, I suppose I'd say? Or did you just learn world politics and history as part of your four-year plan?
No, I definitely didn't learn it as part of my four-year plan. I grew up in an intensely political family, and it seemed that I've been talking about Palestine since I was born. But I still, I mean, genuinely, I couldn't point at Belgium on a map. So my knowledge of other countries, there is many gaps in my knowledge. I live in fear of somebody questioning the name of some head of state to me.
Yes.
But you know what? That doesn't make you a good politician. And I know that anyone can look at a briefing. But I know what gives me my confidence. There's a number of things. So I, on this journey of making my plan, I met an awful lot of high level politicians. Both people who'd been government ministers and shadow ministers and were current government ministers. And without being rude to them, it's not intended to be rude, I just thought I could do that. They don't seem to be, you know, actually it's disarming to spend time with them, actually. Disarming on their part, because actually they're not all that special. It's not that they're not brilliant and clever and know all about their area. They're just normal people.
Yeah.
And actually, if you come from the world and you are actually a specialist on something, and I am a specialist, absolutely, on the thing that I know about. I'm a specialist on home affairs. Policy. I have been before I was elected, I've been advising the Home Office, the Ministry of Justice. I know an awful lot about vulnerable people in the criminal justice system. And actually, if you even just know a lot about one thing,
you are
going to be the smartest person
in the room about that thing. Yeah.
And so, actually, you have a touchstone of I know more about this than you. But it's not easy. Tomorrow I'm going to do a question time thing at Oxford University, and immediately my intellectual sort of confidence dies. I'm doing it with an ex-Liberal MP, somebody from the Taxpayers Alliance, so obviously I'll be cleverer than them, and an Oxford University professor of politics, and I live in fear of the questions they are going to ask me. However, I shall do it because, actually, my touchstone, my confidence will carry me through. My confidence will be the thing that people notice in the room, not necessarily what I say.
Yeah.
And I know I can win an audience over with humanity.
Yeah.
So that.
I was going to say, one of the things that's been quite telling about your, I won't say performance, but your performance as an MP so far, is that you have had an authenticity and conviction about what you say.
Yeah.
Which I guess, in a world, and I don't want to go there too much, but in a world of spin and platitude and weasel words, does cut through.
It definitely does. and it definitely does with an audience, an actual live audience in front of you, if you act human and don't try and act cleverer than them, don't try and be the cleverest person in the room, try and be the nicest. Yeah. People notice that you're nice and you're funny and you're kind and you're interested in them. And politics very much, and all political parties do this, like have your photo handshaking with, you know, another cabinet minister who no one's ever heard of, and they expect you to put that on their leaflet, and that is just politicians talking about politicians. Here's me, politician, with this other politician. Whereas actually we should be talking about the people. And I feel incredibly confident talking to anyone. My mum always used to say I could make friends in an empty room, which I think is a compliment. Either that or you just talk all the time and you don't even notice. So I find I can find confidence through connecting with people very easily. But yeah, I always felt confident enough to do it. After I had got over the initial hurdle of am I clever enough, will I know enough, and everybody's scared of those things you said.
But I met
people who weren't that much more impressive than me, so I thought, what if they can do it?
Yeah, so that imposter syndrome, which we sometimes talk about, and it's just like you just see... okay, yeah, they've got their thing, I got my thing. And you play to your strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. And with regard to it being a brain pit in the House of Commons, that is definitely something I thought before. I thought, oh, it looks like a horrible environment. But I would be lying if I said I didn't join in on it. I am a bit of a street fighter when it comes to politics, and also I suppose it goes back to working in bars. That was actually some of the best training I ever had for being a politician, working in bars.
The rougher the better, probably.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't wilt when people shout at me, and I am tough. I'm, you know, the youngest of four siblings. I'm the only girl. They were all boys, all older than me. I know how to scrap. So I can be a bit scrappy. And you don't think you're going to take part in it. And you do get all snotty and be all like, I will never do that. And then as soon as they're saying something you don't like, you're like, whatever, you know, shouting. So that I think could put people off. But you'd be surprised how quickly you can adapt, is what I'd say to anyone.
Yes, absolutely. So... You've been in the House of Commons now since
May the 8th.
Right, so
six months. So six months, about half a year.
Your first term. What are your hopes or aspirations? What's next? I think within this term,
within the 5 years that I think I will be in the House of Commons, I have already, in fact, in order to make it matter, because it might be my only 5 years, I sort of have a plan of five things that. I want to think that I have achieved by the end of it as a sort of test bed. One of them is to make people believe in politicians a little bit more, be a bit more human, change the way the place is perceived as if it's for everyone, not just for politicians. So open it up a little bit by being a bit more normal. There are a number of specific policy areas that I would want to achieve. And they are almost exclusively around domestic violence, sex work, human trafficking. My expertise, I will use them in those 5 years, because in 5 years' time, I won't have those expertise anymore. I will no longer be an expert on those policies. And I suppose the final thing is about the protection and development of my constituency, and how that looks and how those people perceive me at the end. I ask them how they perceive me all the time. I put it in surveys, genuinely their perception of me and my work. And just even if that shifted one point to give them some faith in politicians, that because the people it hurts when people say you're all the same, we don't trust any politicians, the people that hurts is the people at the bottom, because actually they're the people who really need representatives. The people at the top can represent themselves. So... just trust in politicians would be what is the overarching aim of my 5 years.
Yeah. Well, Jess, I really wish you all the best of luck in that. I can see that you've already made a great start in some of those things, and you know, more power to your elbow, they say. thank you so much for coming and sharing some of your thoughts here. It's great to have people in power who are willing to share their insights and be human. I think, as you say, humanising that makes it just more accessible and allows society to shift in a much more positive way. So, Jess, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
So, if I wanted to say right now that I wondered whether, as much as I liked Little Mix, why they have to cavort around in their underwear, or that perhaps we don't really need an International Man's Day, or that it might be a nice idea for Jane Austen to feature on the back of the £20 note. Now I've said these things out loud, do I deserve to have my life threatened? Do I deserve to have people want to rape me or mutilate me? And do I deserve to have that written for lots of people to see on the internet? Because that's what's happened to a number of women recently, Sally Hughes, Jess Phillips, and Caroline Criado Perez. It seems that women can't have an opinion on the internet without a coterie of individuals, and they can be men or women, saying vile things about them. It really puzzles me as to why that is happening. If they were saying things that were hugely controversial, and God knows women have said some dreadful things online and got slammed for it, I could understand it, but these are just opinions, just a point of view. How can they be so dangerous that they would warrant such outrage and such an outpouring? I'm actually getting a bit concerned that Twitter and some social media outlets allow that to happen. Not because they won't control it. Of course, they can't. There's a freedom of speech issue here. But these forums just allow random thoughts from violent people, or maybe violent thoughts from random people, to be aired and given airtime. It's made me want to look at Twitter less, because I don't want to hang out in a space where people feel that it's okay to do that. You wouldn't hang out in a room where people were shouting that at you, so why would you do that in a virtual space? I haven't really got an answer for this, but it does make me wonder, why can't women have an opinion on the internet? That's all for this time. Thanks for listening to the Creative Shift podcast, recorded in the analogue delights of Highbury Studio. Big shout out to John and our engineer Rob. Tune in next time for more insight, comment, and of course, a rant or two. Bye.